Episode 82, The Revolutions of 1848. Hi, my name is Clayton Mills. Welcome to A Short Walk Through Our Long History, a podcast where we look at the events of history and examine how those events shaped our modern world. I keep meaning to point out that I have an email and a website for this podcast, but I keep forgetting to mention it. Anyway, the email is shortwalkthroughhistory@gmail.com, and the website is shortwalkthroughhistory.com. You can see them both in the bio for the podcast on your podcast app. So last episode, we looked at the massive flow of people that moved west along the Oregon Trail in the United States, and I mentioned that it was part of one of the biggest migrations in history. Well, part of the reason that there were a lot of people migrating to the west was that there were a lot of people fleeing Europe in 1848. Why? Because there were revolutions happening all over Europe, and people were fleeing the tensions and the fighting there. And I'm going to give you a bit of a spoiler here. All of the European revolutions of 1848 are going to fail. In fact, it's kind of a depressing story. I found this quote about the whole thing. "The revolutions of 1848 were a series of republican revolts against European monarchies, beginning in Sicily and spreading to France, Germany, Italy, and the Austrian Empire." It actually went farther than that. "They all ended in failure and repression, and were followed by widespread disillusionment among liberals." See, even the Britannica website finds this story kind of depressing. Before I go talking about this topic, I want to first put in another plug for Mike Duncan's podcast, Revolution. So Mike Duncan goes into a lot more detail on what happened in 1848 than I will be able to do here in this one single episode. He goes over everything that happens over the course of several episodes. His podcast covers a whole lot of different revolutions, starting with the English Civil War, the American Revolution, and all the South American revolutions, the French Revolution, and then all through the other small revolutions like Haiti, etc., up to the Russian Revolution. And it also covers the revolutions of 1848 and a few others. He goes into great detail and covers all the main characters, all the main events, things that I can only touch on and mention here. It's a great podcast, well worth the time. And before I get to the actual revolution of 1848, we need to look at a couple of things that were happening in the early 1840s in Europe that set the stage for the chaos of 1848. And first of all, and this is really important, there was the Irish potato famine that started in the early 1840s, and that spread to other parts of Europe. There were also some other poor harvests, some disastrous, catastrophic harvests, so that by the mid-1840s, food was scarce in many rural areas, and food was expensive all over Europe. There were over 400 food riots in France in just 1846 and 1847. So people were rioting, trying to get food. Now all this rioting and chaos and famine pushed additional people into the cities, trying to find food and find work. But those were hard to find in the city as well. Living conditions in the cities, especially big cities like Paris, were pretty awful in the poor parts of town. And whenever you have a large group of young men without them having any work to do, they will inevitably start to cause political unrest. It's like a law or something. And tied to this, there were also a couple of years of economic recession, which culminated in the Panic of 1847. And in this panic, a lot of manufacturing companies across Europe went bankrupt, which eliminated a whole lot of factory jobs. So, more angry young men and women with nothing to do. On top of this, there were also the massive changes that were being brought on by the Industrial Revolution, as profitable trades like being a cobbler or maybe a leathersmith or something like that were substantially undercut by cheaper factory-made materials. This affected all sorts of industries, including all kinds of manufacturing, textiles, construction, transportation, and even food production. So all of this led to several years of bad, bad living for the poor, both urban and rural, and it affected the middle class as well. But as is typical in these sort of things, the wealthy, of course, got wealthier. The income differential between the rich and the poor grew dramatically. I guess there are sort of cyclical seasons of this kind of thing, as the rich squeeze the poor until the poor, who are always more numerous, push back. We're in one of those cycles right now. Hopefully, the pushback is coming. And those pushbacks are rarely peaceful. Now, all of these revolutions in Europe are going to ask basically for the same things. And they saw some of these things in the U.S. Constitution and Bill of Rights and in the first French Revolution's Declaration of the Rights of Man. The revolutionaries, at least the educated middle class ones, are going to demand constitutions that guarantee individual liberties. They're going to demand universal suffrage, at least for men, rather than voting being controlled only by the landowners. Some of the revolutions even tried to do away with the monarchies of their countries completely and replace them with republics. Some of the revolutions were just aiming for like constitutional monarchies. In any case, they all wanted to limit the power of the king and the nobles and bring about more of a balance of power between the rich and the poor. Well, that's what the educated middle class revolutionaries wanted anyway. The poor just wanted food and jobs. The actual revolutions began in January of 1848 in Italy. Italy at the time was not a unified nation. It was more of a collection of individual Italian sort of nation states, which were pretty much dominated by the Austrian Empire to the north. Discontent with Austrian rule grew throughout Italy, as well as Sicily growing increasingly unhappy with French Bourbon rule. In January, Sicily revolted and created its own republic, which actually had a very well thought out constitution with guarantees of civil rights and universal male suffrage. The Sicilian Republic also passed a resolution suggesting creating a unified Italy, which would have included Sicily. All of this triggered a response in Italy. In February, the remnants of the old nation state of Venice came together and created the Republic of San Marco, and soon joined the Kingdom of Sardinia to create an all-Italian resistance to the Austrians. Other small duchies and kingdoms to the south also revolted against Austrian rule. There was a very real movement to unify all of Italy under the red, white, and green tricolor flag that eventually became the official flag of Italy that we know today. But in the end, the Italian kingdoms were not all that unified, nor were they well armed. And the Austrians were very well armed. So some of Italy joined together and declared themselves a republic, but Austria is about to come down and squash that action right away. Anyway, this may or may not have triggered a response in France. The Bourbon king of the time, Louis Philippe, after having given some Republican concessions in 1847, had then swung back the other way and begun to crack down on some freedoms, including outlawing any public gatherings. In response, the French opposition, who were mostly middle class, began organizing huge invitation-only outdoor banquets. It was supposedly a banquet and they did serve some food, but it was also an occasion for anti-monarchy speeches and organizing. It was known as the Campaign of Banquets, and since they were invitation-only banquets, they sort of circumvented the law about public gatherings. So in early 1848, Louis Philippe outlawed the banquets as well. In response to Louis Philippe's ban, the opposition scheduled a banquet on February 22nd, which was meant to honor George Washington's birthday, since he was sort of a symbol of freedom. But it was prevented from happening by French authorities, and this led to riots in the streets of Paris. The riots spread to other parts of France, and in late February, Louis, in fear of his life, abdicated in favor of his young son. But the rest of France rejected him too, and later in 1848, a French assembly created the Second French Republic. Now, if you're creating a republic, wouldn't it be smart to elect a Republican president? Yes, it would, but this is France. Instead, they elected, of all people, the nephew of Napoleon, who will, in 1851, just like his uncle, declare himself Emperor of France and the establishment of the Second French Empire. Yes, France will eventually become a republic, but we're still a good ways off from that. Anyway, throughout much of 1848, France was working out the details of a second French Revolution that's going to fail, although not quite as catastrophically as the first one. So all the revolutions of 1848, including this big French one, are going to come to naught. So where were we? Okay, late February, 1848. Now, March. It's March, so now it's Germany's turn. Okay, that's right. In the south and west of Germany, that is the parts that are near France, large groups of students, teachers, lawyers, and other intellectuals led a series of mass demonstrations, which were all demanding the same things. More voting rights, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, a new constitution, and economic reforms. But the uprisings were poorly organized, and the lower class and the educated middle class were not really on the same page about what they wanted. Eventually, the upper class, who effectively controlled the military, squashed all the revolts and enforced even more strict laws against mass gatherings. This issue of the lower classes and middle classes not being on the same page about what they wanted is going to undo basically all the revolutions of 1848. The revolutions just didn't have the unity that they needed to truly unseat the powers that were in charge of their countries. In the monarchical systems of Europe at the time, the military was usually controlled by the nobles, since it was their sons who were the officers of the military. And if the lower and the middle classes were not united, it was much easier for the upper class and the military to put down a revolt. Okay, March, right? Germany. That was what happened in March. What's next? Okay, as it turns out, just next door. At the end of March in 1848, the revolutions spread to the Austrian Empire as well. Of all the empires in Europe, the Austrian Empire was the least homogeneous. The Austrian Empire controlled Austria, of course, much of Italy, Bohemia, which is now Czechoslovakia, lots of small Slavic areas like Serbia, they controlled all of Hungary, and they controlled a few other bits of territory. And this included a lot of different ethnic groups, including like the Czechs, the Serbs, the Slovaks, the Magyars, which are the people who made up most of Hungary. And in addition to being not very homogeneous, of all these empires that we're looking at today, Austria was also the least industrialized and had the smallest middle class and the least intellectuals. So it was also the most polarized between rich and poor. Clemens Wenzel Nepomuk Lothar, Prince of Metternich-Wittenberg zu Bilstein, who is usually just known as Metternich, of course, was the Chancellor of the Austrian Empire. I would have liked to have been around if he had been introduced to Santa Anna. Signor General Antonio de Padua Maria Severino Lopez de Santa Anna y Perez de Lebron, meet Chancellor Clemens Wenzel Nepomuk Lothar, Prince of Metternich-Wittenberg zu Bilstein. By the time you finished introducing him, everyone would have been already done with their dinner. Anyway, Metternich was the Chancellor of Austria, and he probably held more power than the Austrian Emperor, Emperor Ferdinand. But he was a firm supporter of the monarchy and a firm opponent of the wave of democratic reform that was trying to sweep Europe. And I mean like very firm, like arrest them all and let them all rot in jail firm, like send the army to crush the uprising firm. In March of 1848, a group of Magyar intellectuals in Hungary, led by Louis Kossuth, staged a series of demonstrations in Hungary demanding reform and a separate Hungarian constitution. These demonstrations spread all over Hungary and soon spread even to Vienna, and there was so much chaos that even Metternich was forced to flee the city. But the news that he had left further emboldened the protesters, and soon there were complimentary protests all over the Austrian Empire, including in Bohemia and in Italy. But by midsummer, the revolutions had begun to run out of steam. They were never really supported by the working class of Austria. In June of 1848, there was a conference in Prague that was intended to unite all of the Slavic peoples, but it turned into an ongoing violent protest, and so Metternich, to keep order, sent in the Austrian army and crushed the uprising and arrested all of the leaders of it. He also sent Austrian armies into Italy, and this was when the fledgling Italian Republic was also crushed. By the end of the summer, Austria and Italy were firmly in the hands of the Habsburg dynasty, and the Austrian and Italian revolutions were over. But the Hungarians, and especially the Magyar people, were more determined, and later, in September and October, Louis Kossuth led a series of demonstrations in Hungary demanding that Hungarian, not German, be the official language of Hungary, and also demanding a Hungarian constitution. But the Serbians and Croatians who lived in Hungary, who were not Magyar people and didn't speak Hungarian, they rebelled against the rebellion, and they asked the Austrians for help. So the Austrians, who were busy elsewhere, asked the Russians for help, and the Imperial Russian army invaded Hungary and crushed this uprising too. By the end of the year, all of the Republican uprisings across Europe, except in France, had been crushed and the monarchies restored, and the French one's going to fall apart the next year. All of the monarchies had responded by cracking down on all the dissent that they saw, and Austria particularly became basically a police state for a while, and all forms of protest were repressed. And here we'll see a principle that I will come back to in a minute. When a popular uprising fails, the reigning powers will usually respond by cracking down on the masses. But those crackdowns, can only last for so long. The revolution in France led to the establishment of the Second French Republic. But like I said, the Republic elected the nephew of Napoleon, and like his uncle, he quickly converted the Second French Republic into the Second French Empire. So that one failed as well. And by the end of 1849, all of Europe was once again controlled by some kind of monarchical power. In the end, all of the freedoms that had been demanded, new constitution, freedom of the press, freedom of assembly, universal male suffrage, all of them were removed all across Europe. The revolutions failed. All of them. Most of the revolutions failed because the leaders were all middle-class intellectuals, and they had their ideals and the things that they wanted, but they couldn't get the lower class to support them because the lower class cared about different things. And without the sheer numbers of the lower class, it was easy for the upper class, who controlled the military, to arrest and control the relatively few middle class leaders. Once those people are arrested, the revolts died out. One of the things, though, that did come out of the revolutions of 1848 was an increased urgency behind the ideas of both German and Italian unification. Even though the revolutions had been crushed, the idea of German unification and Italian unification had taken root in both of those places. And over the next couple of decades, both Germany and Italy would become united countries. The stresses that had created the uprisings in the first place had not been abated. They had just been repressed. And all of these stresses are going to bubble back up to the surface again and are eventually going to become part of the catalysts for the Russian Revolution and World War I. The tension between the mass of people in the working classes and the difficulties of their lives, as compared to the relatively few of the ruling class and the ease of their lives, is still going to have an effect on Europe in the 1800s and then again in the 1900s, and then again in 2024. And that tension between the working class and the elites was also played out very recently in our modern world. I have a good example of this. In 1997, the city of Hong Kong was transferred from Great Britain back to China, as Britain, for once, honored the terms of a treaty that it had made with China. Most of the people of Hong Kong, though they were of Chinese descent, did not want to become part of communist China, but the British let them go anyway. At first, Hong Kong enjoyed a sort of special jurisdiction within communist China, where the laws were different, and the sort of individual liberties like freedom of the press and freedom of assembly, the right to due process of law, etc., were still protected. Those things you couldn't find in communist China, but they were still protected in Hong Kong. But in late 2014, a series of laws were passed by the Chinese government that restricted freedoms in Hong Kong. And this resulted in almost 3 months of protests, including large groups of people peacefully occupying key roadways and bridges in Hong Kong, which brought traffic all over the city to a standstill. By the end of the year, police actions had cleared out all the protesters, and many of the leaders were arrested. But the people saw how effective these kind of protests could be. In February of 2019, China forced the local government of Hong Kong to pass a law that said that people accused of crimes in Hong Kong could be extradited back to China before they even had a trial. Now, in China, it's well known that those people would often disappear into the jail system for years without ever facing any kind of jury or going through a trial. China is not known for due process of law. It's a communist state, and the rulers have basically absolute power to do whatever they want. Human rights aren't guaranteed, and if the government arrests you and takes you away, well, there's no real recourse. So, after China passed this law, forced Hong Kong to pass the law, the people of Hong Kong rose up in protest. In late February of 2019, Students, intellectuals, and others in Hong Kong who had grown up in the relative freedom of British rule staged mass protests in the streets, demanding the repeal of the law. Tens of thousands of people again occupied parts of the city, again bringing traffic and business to a standstill. People in Hong Kong began to agitate for actual independence from China. And many people were seen during these protests waving U.S. flags. Bit of an irony there. And at this time, despite police efforts to squelch the protests, people stayed in the streets, especially around Hong Kong University. And these protests lasted until late 2019. And I'm sure many of you who are listening were alive then and actually remember what happened in late 2019. If you can't get the students off the streets using the police, well, you should switch tactics and use a pandemic. The widely over-exaggerated effects of the coronavirus and some probably fabricated images of bodies in the streets in Wuhan did what the police couldn't do. Immediately, all the streets of Hong Kong were empty, and the protests stopped. The Chinese, as a people, are a little bit germphobic already, and this propaganda effort was instantly successful. Everyone went and hid indoors, and the protests evaporated overnight. I'm sure that if Metternich and the other conservative leaders of Europe in 1848 had thought of using a plague to clear the streets of Vienna, they would have used it. The people in power don't like it when the bulk of the people, the 99% who aren't in power, take to the streets. In the end, it really is the people, the 99%, who actually have the most power. This goes all the way back to the Roman Republic and the creation of the Roman Assembly, which represented not the patricians, but the plebeians. The people are always more numerous than the elite. And so the elite have to find ways to keep themselves in power rather than being overrun by the sheer mass of the poor. Pandemics, Patriot Acts, inflation, the IRS, control of the national media, ongoing fear-mongering propaganda about racism, immigration, and gender, all of these are things that seem to be designed to keep the 99% of the people divided so that instead of uniting and pulling off an 1848 again, all the poor people stay divided and thinking that each other is the enemy rather than seeing that they're being oppressed by the rich. So, in the end, the revolutions of 1848 were crushed by the people at the top because the middle and lower classes were not united in what they wanted. So I guess division is a workable strategy. Maybe there's some way we could use it to divide the people at the top. Well, for now, we need to leave Hong Kong and travel back east, back to the United States, in 1860, as we begin to watch another kind of division, as we begin to watch the House divide.